A number of years ago, I read Robert Cialdini's book on persuasion, and I still have it. I have it in my library, and I still consult it from time to time. But in that book, he tells an interesting story that teaches us a lot about influence, about persuasion. Obviously, that's his whole book is researching that subject. How do we persuade one another? But the story is about the owner of a jewelry store who was having trouble selling some of the merchandise. The owner had tried everything, every trick in the book to sell this merchandise. All of the conventional sales tricks, nothing worked. The merchandise, the jewelry, just didn't sell. On her way out of town for a business trip, she scribbled a note to the service manager, and she told her to cut the price in half and get rid of this jewelry. She wrote, "Everything in this display case, price X, one half." And then she went on her trip. Well, all of the jewelry sold out before she got back from her business trip. The surprising part was that the manager misread the note. She had read one half as two. Instead of slashing the original price, she doubled it. She doubled the price of jewelry that couldn't sell, and she sold it all out. Why? He explains that people never questioned the true value of the jewelry. They just made an assumption we often make, that more expensive equals greater value. And that's why it's sold. We live in a world where the price tags have been changed, where things that are very valuable in our world have no value in the kingdom, zero value. And things that have great value in the kingdom have no value here. The price tags have been switched. Our values are skewed by the price tags of our world. In Luke chapter 21, Jesus teaches us about money. I thought it was ironic that my first time back after a couple of months away and I get a subject of money to talk to the congregation about. Jesus is talking about money here. Money talks, we know that. And I see two principles in this passage. Money talks to God about our values in verses 1 through 4 of Luke 21. Let's read them. "And he, Jesus, looked up and saw the rich putting their gifts into the treasury. And he saw a poor widow putting in two small copper coins. And he said, 'Truly I say to you, the poor widow put in more than all of them. For they all out of their surplus put into the offering, but she out of her poverty put in all that she had to live on.'" There is a large-scale model of first century Jerusalem, which you can walk around and study, and it's well worth doing that. I highly recommend it because the model gives us a perspective of the city as it existed in the time of Jesus. And when we were there, we certainly made time to look at this large-scale model. The court of Gentiles occupied the largest space in the temple. Anyone was allowed into the court of the Gentiles. From the court of the Gentiles, you would ascend 15 steps up into the court of women. Now, it is Tuesday of Jesus' last week on earth as we come to Luke 21. Jesus has been teaching in the court of Gentiles, but now he moves to the court of women. And he takes a seat to do some people watching. Do you like to do people watching? I love people watching, especially airports are a great place to people watch, you know. God has a great sense of humor because people are really interesting to watch. Jesus is people watching in the court of women in the temple. There were 13 brass treasure chests scattered around the court of women. These treasure chests were called trumpets because they were brass enclosures in the shape of an inverted trumpet. So it was narrow at the top with a large area at the bottom. And people would drop their coins into these trumpets, these treasure chests. And they made a nice sound as the money clattered down into these brass trumpets. Each of the trumpets was labeled something different. So, for example, one was labeled bird offerings, another was labeled wood for the sacrifices, another was gold for the mercy seat, and then six of these trumpets were labeled free will offerings. The gifts of the people funded the temple treasury through these trumpet treasure chests. The Passover, of course, has brought large crowds of people into the temple, and they're parading by the collection plates, putting money in the treasury. And Jesus is watching them. Money dropped into these brass trumpets made a wonderful sound when you had big coins and lots of them. So the wealthy would come by and they'd make a show of putting lots of coins into the treasure chest and they'd clatter and everybody would say, "Whoa, look at these people, they are so holy, they are so spiritual." Lots of money going into the treasure chest. They look good. People would be impressed. It's, I suppose, a bit like how some come to church for show. You got to look good so people will think you're holy and spiritual in church. Well, the sound of coins tinkling in the trumpets called attention to these grand givers. As he's watching, one lonely poor widow standing in line, arriving up to the brass trumpet to put her gift in. She put two small coins into the trumpet. They're called lepta. Lepta means thin, or literally peeled, like the peeling of an apple. Very thin, very tiny, and hardly make a sound. Not impressive. Nobody paid attention to her. Each of the coins was worth about 1/8 of one penny. So she gave 1/4 of a penny to the temple treasury. Jesus pointed out the widow to his disciples who were there with him, and he said she gave more than all. Some translations say more than any of them, but the Greek literally can be understood to mean more than all of them put together. More than all those wealthy people, she gave more than them. 1/4 of a penny. How is that possible? Well, Jesus goes on to explain. The others gave out of their extra money, out of their surplus. She gave out of her poverty. Jesus says that she gave all she had for life. Many writers have pointed out that she gave 2 coins. Interesting. She could very easily, it's free will offering, she could very easily have put in 1 coin and kept 1 coin out for herself. Maybe for lunch that day. She didn't do that. She gave all she had into the offering. The late Christian businessman Fred Smith liked to say, "God entrusts us with money as a test. For like a toy to the child, it is training for handling things of more value." God entrusts his money to us as a test, because we are like children. And like a toy entrusted to us, we're going to find out if we can handle something of greater value than money. That's what God is doing with the money he entrusts to us. If God gives us money as a training tool, then what can we learn from this poor widow? What does the widow teach us about giving? I mean, Jesus wants to teach us about money here. He's giving us a lesson from this poor widow. We need to learn God's values so we can live out God's values with respect to giving. Jesus is teaching us, first of all, that giving flows from love. Giving flows from love. God cares more about our attitudes in giving than he cares about the amount of our gift. God doesn't need your money. God doesn't need my money. God owns it all. He owns everything in this universe. He doesn't need my money. God wants our hearts. God wants our wills, our lives. Because if God has our hearts, then he'll have our money. If he has us, he has our wallets. The spirit behind our giving is more important to God than the amount of our gift. If we give our money to earn God's favor, that's not giving. If we give our money to look good to other people, that's not giving. If we give our money out of a sense of duty and obligation, that's not giving. If I have to give, it's not a gift. If I have to pay my taxes, you have to pay your taxes. The IRS doesn't care one bit what I feel about paying my taxes. They don't care if I'm happy about paying my taxes. I honestly can say I can't remember being happy about paying my taxes. They don't care at all if I'm happy about paying my taxes. I just have to pay them. God cares if I'm happy about giving to him, though, because God cares about my heart. God cares about the spirit with which I give. Giving is not paying taxes to God. Giving flows from love for God. Secondly, God measures what we give by what we keep. Ouch. God measures what we give by what we keep. From 2000 to 2010, Americans spent $180 billion per year on gambling. We've got the casinos in Maine. $180 billion per year on gambling. The money spent on gambling in that decade was 15 times more than the total money given to churches across America. Means that there was a fair bit of money given to churches, but not in comparison. We have lots of money, even among Christians. God's not impressed with the amount of money collected in American churches. Why? We are giving out of our surplus. We got plenty of money to spend on other things. So God's not impressed. God cares more about how that giving compares to what we use for ourselves. The widow gave all she had, and that counted more to God than the wealth of all those who gave much, much more into the treasury. If I make $100,000 a year and I give $5,000, I'm giving 5% of my income. I got to keep it at easy numbers here. 5%. Someone else might make $25,000 a year and give $2,500. So they gave half what I gave. But they gave 10%. So they gave much more than I gave. That's God's math. God measures what we give by what we keep. Third, little is much in the hands of God. This poor widow's two little coins have been used by God to teach God's people about giving for the last 2,000 years. Great example. Her pennies have been converted into billions and billions of dollars down through history by God. God can do great things with tiny offerings. Giving is an investment that we make here on earth that pays dividends in eternity. The return for what we give here, we will not see until eternity comes to us in His kingdom. And God does amazing things through our little gifts. So never, please, never be discouraged by the little that you have to give to God. Give it gladly. He'll use it for Him and His kingdom. He'll multiply our small gifts for His kingdom work. I had the privilege of preaching at the Sunday morning worship service in San Ysidro, Panama, a few weeks ago. Look, they don't have much wealth at all. It's a very poor, impoverished area, but they have a joy that is infectious. It is challenging to worship together with them. They sing, they clap, they dance in worship. The music is loud, it is passionate, it is full of joy. It's very loud, actually. They made me come because I was preaching, so they made me come sit up at the platform. So I was about this far away from that plant to me, from the speakers that they were using in that tiny brick, that tiny concrete building. I think my insides were vibrating. They love to sing. They know how to worship the Lord with great enthusiasm. I asked them, actually, if we could take some of their worship leaders back to America to teach us how to worship with some excitement. They were glad to do that if we'd do that. They'd be glad to come to Galilee. But anyway, they took up an offering that Sunday. I guess they probably do most Sundays. I reached into my wallet. I saw that I had $30 in my wallet, a 10 and a 20. I grabbed the 10 and I dropped it in the offering plate as it went by. I always carried a little money with me for whatever, bottled water. We always drank bottled water there, whatever we needed. I might need something. They continued to pass the collection plate, and it hit me. Why didn't I grab the 20? Why did I grab the 10? I have so much. They have so little. They are gladly giving. The thought crossed my mind, well, I should keep a little cash on hand in case of an emergency today. It's like God rebuked that thought real quick. Have you ever had these conversations with God? Really, God said? Really, that's your excuse? I can't take care of you? I was really convicted. At that point in my conversation with God, I was thinking about, okay, I wish I'd brought more. So when things went on and the offering plate sitting next to me on the platform, I reached in and took the 20 out and dropped it in gladly to give to the Lord's work there. And I truly wish that I had put more money in my wallet to give to them. Money talks to God about our values. What do we value? But God has to talk to us about our money. Principle number two. God talks to us about our money, verses 5 and 6. And quite frankly, when I go to places like Panama, I am convicted about my choices in life, for sure. Verse 5. And while some were talking about the temple, that it was adorned with beautiful stones and votive gifts, he said, as for these things which you are looking at, the days will come in which there will not be left one stone upon another which will not be torn down. God is talking to them about their money. Mark's gospel tells us that as they were walking out of the temple on Tuesday afternoon of Passion Week, the disciples were admiring the grandeur of the temple. They were talking with pride because the Jewish people took great pride in their temple. talking about the great stones, the golden ornaments that made this temple the object of worship among the Jewish people. They came to worship the building more than they worshiped God. The temple was incredible. It was one of the wonders of the Roman world. Most of the stones weighed between 2 to 4 tons each. Some weighed as much as 10 tons, and a few on the southwestern corner of the temple weighed as much as 50 tons each. One massive foundational stone, which we looked at down, now way down underground now, weighs 570 tons. This was a massive building. The beauty of the temple was extraordinary. It was covered with gold plating, so that it literally shone so bright that people sometimes had to turn their eyes away from the temple. Much of the exterior was covered in gold. The columns were 40 feet high, made of white marble, each one carved from a single marble block. Jeweled sculptures adorned the walls. One famous ornament was a giant vine made of gold. The golden grape clusters were as tall as a man, and that's just the grapes. This was an incredible place, and the first century Jewish people valued the temple more than almost anything else, which is why they gave to the treasury so freely. As long as they had the house of God, they were safe. He was with them. Not according to Jesus. Not according to Jesus. What did Jesus say? He predicted the destruction of the temple. Just days before he was to be crucified, he predicted that the house of God would be destroyed. Their value system was all wrong. He said that not one stone would be left upon another. And the fulfillment of Jesus' prophecy, of course we know now, came in 70 AD when the Roman armies under Titus conquered Jerusalem. Titus originally intended that they would protect the temple because of its beauty, but the soldiers set fire to it. So with the destruction that came from that fire, he decided to raze the temple, destroy it completely. Many of the soldiers, seeking gold that was in the rock structures, actually pulled apart rocks trying to get at the gold for themselves, leaving the stones torn down from this massive temple. Today, when we look at the temple, we're actually looking at a rebuilt temple using some of the original stones. This is the Western Wall. They don't call it the Wailing Wall anymore. It's the Western Wall. The 7 lowest courses on the Western Wall where the Jewish people go to worship on Sabbath, and that's an amazing experience to join them there. Brian, I think you just came back a little while ago. Just an amazing experience. But the 7 lowest courses on the Western Wall are Herodian blocks with 21 courses underground are Herodian. When we visited, we went underground to tour the archaeological excavations going back to the time of Herod. But the top stones that you see here on the wall are all modern. They were added because the Jewish people wanted to stop the Arabs from throwing garbage over the top of the wall on the Jewish worshipers down below. So they added height to that wall to stop the garbage. Wow, the temple was destroyed because the hearts of the people had turned away from God. They were worshiping their building and not their God. And they had rejected the Messiah of God's grace. What bothers you about that picture and the caption? Something should. We should see something wrong with that picture. Well, not wrong in the sense of inaccurate, but King David wanted to build the first temple. You remember the story of King David? He wanted to build the temple, but God said, "Your hands are too bloody." and so it will be for your son Solomon to build my temple." But David, so committed to the Lord, decided to make preparations for the temple. And as he gathered the initial stones and all of the work that was done, he was preparing to make the temple. In 1 Chronicles 22, he used the name the House of God. "This is for the House of God which Solomon will build." And from that time on, it was called the House of God. And Herod's temple was built on the same spot as Solomon's temple, which was originally Mount Moriah. This place is God's house. But look at the picture. The Dome of the Rock sits where the temple once stood. The Al-Aqsa Mosque is located on the Temple Mount. When you get permission to go up into the Temple Mount area, you have to be very respectful because it is controlled by the Gentiles. The house of God is controlled by Gentiles. What happened to God's house? The Muslims own it today. What happened? God judged his own house. That tells you something very important about God's values, even for us today. God judged his own house, and God will judge his own house today too, if he needs to, if we forget him, if we turn away from him and no longer follow him. The temple in Jerusalem is a great object lesson for all of us about God's values. People gave vast sums of money to make the house of God one of the wonders of the Roman world. God allowed the Gentiles to destroy the house of God. And we still live in the times of the Gentiles. And that's why the picture is so striking. God will one day rebuild his house on this site. I believe the scriptures teach that. And the world will one day worship Jesus Christ there on this site. The Israelites will one day turn to follow Jesus Christ as their Messiah and worship him here. That promise comes from Zechariah, the prophet in the Old Testament, long before Jesus. Comes from Jesus too. For now, though, we live in the times of the Gentiles, and the Gentiles rule the Temple Mount until Christ returns. The rest of Luke chapter 21, which we'll look at in the next few weeks, Jesus will lay out the future, which gives us a panoramic view of what God is doing down through history. And we will look at what he had to say in the weeks ahead. But Jesus, this Passion Week, has already said, God's house, you made a den of robbers. And that den of robbers rejected the Messiah. And God destroyed his house. You see, God's values are not our values. He cares less about the temple than the hearts of his people. And he cares less about all the stuff we think is so important than he cares about our hearts, our wills. What matters to God? It's not our buildings, but our hearts. Jesus doesn't want our money. It's so wrong to think that way. He wants our hearts. He wants our wills. Jesus doesn't want our buildings. He wants our lives. If Jesus has our hearts, he has our money and our buildings. So we have such a warped sense of values that we think God is impressed with our money, with our buildings, with all of the things that we can do here in America. And God isn't impressed at all. Not one bit. We can spend millions in America on our brick and mortar, on our plans and on our goals and all of those agendas, but if we forget God, then God will judge us too, just as he judged his house. Jesus sits in every church treasury, watching the treasury. He examines our budgets. He evaluates our priorities, because how we spend our money expresses where our hearts are focused, expresses our values. And what does God see? What does Jesus see in our budgets and in our buildings and in our programs here at Galilee? It's not our wealth, but our mission. God gave the nation of Israel a mission. Their mission was to show the world the God of grace and glory, the God of greatness. They failed, and God judged them. Jesus left us with a mission to reach the world with the gospel of his kingdom. He blesses us with the resources to do what he calls us to do. Are we using them for his mission? We can hoard his resources, because that's what they are. We can hoard his resources and keep them for ourselves, or we can spend those resources to do our part to reach this world. How do you think we're doing? Don't answer that out loud. How do you think we're doing as a church? How do you think we're doing as individuals? I was convicted. I always am when I go to Panama or some of the other places in this world. I was convicted again this year in Panama, as I just shared. They have so little, but they're committed to such a great mission. They have such a vision. This is a picture of one of the young pastors that I taught. His name is Abdel. This is his living room, but it's also their church sanctuary, because they meet in the house. Most of the churches are house churches. You can see the drums, the keyboard, and the screen there in the background. And they gather in the living room here for worship. It's the town of Bugaba. He was explaining his vision for what God had called him to do through him. And then he shared a song with us. He's a singer, has a very fine voice. And it was, I couldn't understand the words, obviously, but a wonderful song that he shared with us that day. Abdel and his wife have three children. They started the church in February. They're up to 25 regular worshipers each week, and 80 who gather from the various life groups around the city of Bugaba, other little house churches, other little life, they call them life groups. Once a month, 80 of them gather together in their living room and out the doors and everywhere else. Abdel also pastors a church in Panama City, 8 hours away. So on Tuesdays, he drives 8 hours to Panama City and is there pastoring that church from Tuesday through Friday. They have their worship service on Thursday night in Panama City. Then he comes back and he's pastoring the church in Bugaba from Friday through Monday. He pastors two churches 8 hours apart. That's a commute. His wife works full-time so he can serve the Lord. We met her as well. He buys fruits and vegetables at the farms in western Panama, and he carries them in sacks to Panama City, and he sells them on the street in Panama City to pay for his provisions for his trip each week. We're standing here in his yard as he explains how he wants to add on to his house on the side. Originally, he wanted to go in the back and build a large building for more and more people to come. He has a vision for reaching hundreds and hundreds of people in the city of Bugaba, but they've talked him into a side building here where they could meet because they've outgrown their little house and they want to put on an addition here. And so we met, we talked with him, listened to his vision, and then we gathered in a circle and had a prayer of dedication for the ministry there in Bugaba. He and his wife, they're following Christ with great commitment, great sacrifice to the Lord's mission. And I come away saying, how about us? So when I come back to our ministry and our work here, I think, God, what about me? How am I serving you? How committed am I to your mission? You see, God's values shape our values. That's the way he works. And God's values focus on people and eternity. People and eternity. God's values. Everything we have here on earth is passing away. Everything. Calvin Seibert is an artist. He creates his masterpieces out of sand. He builds sand castles. His finished artwork is far from ordinary. The sand castles are grand, they're majestic, they're beautiful works of art. And he's been creating these sand castle masterpieces for many years, since he was a child, actually. But for some reason, he doesn't mind their short lifespans. A sand castle doesn't last very long. It could collapse right now, he told the journalists interviewing him. You got to be okay with it. He doesn't try to make money off it or get credit for it. I want to do something all the time and be creative, he said. And if nobody ever knew about it, I'd still be building a sandcastle. Now, you might expect me to draw an analogy to our lives by pointing out how sad it is to devote ourselves to building sandcastles instead of things that last. And I suppose that would be a good application, but I want to go in a slightly different direction. I want you to think about this. You see, I like his attitude. I like his attitude. He is building sandcastles that he knows will not last. But he will pour everything into those sandcastles. They will be destroyed in a moment, and he's fine with that reality. He's busy creating his art, even if he never gets credit for it. And in a sense, we are all like Calvin Seibert. All that we do here on this earth, all of these buildings, all of our homes, all of our careers, all of the stuff we do here on earth is like building a sandcastle. Some of our sandcastles look pretty impressive. Others, they're pretty ordinary sandcastles. But here's the thing. They all get wiped out one day. They're all gone in a moment. Our lives are like vapor that passes away, the breath on a cold morning, here today, gone tomorrow. All that remains is God and you, God and me. It's not the size of our sandcastles that matters to God. Could care less. It's the focus of our hearts. Do we do what we do all for him? And that is the lesson of the widow's pennies. Father, oh, you are so good to me, I know. You are so good to us. You bless us. And you don't begrudge us the joy of what you give to us as a father gives good gifts to his children. But you call us to live for you, to do everything we do for you, knowing full well that in time, all of our lives will be wiped out. And all that we do on this earth will not last. It will be turned over to someone else, children, whoever, inheritance. All of the monuments to our efforts will be gone. But we have you, and we have what we do for you, and that will last for all of eternity. Help us to live this week looking at eternity. In Jesus' name, amen.